Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a world transformed by emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. And we are on an adventure, a 10-week adventure exploring all the amazing transformations that we see happening in our world today. And this week will be part three of that adventure as we get into nanotechnology. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing?
Excellent, man. I'm very excited about tonight's program.
We have got a terrific panel lined up to talk about nanotechnology. In fact, I can't think of a more esteemed panel that could be assembled, really, on this particular topic. We've got about 90 minutes to talk about some nanotechnology. So I say, Stephen, why don't we bring the panel out and let's get started.
No time like the present. We have three guests tonight. The first is Jay Storrs Hall. He is a scientist, a visionary, an entrepreneur, and the president of the Foresight Institute. Welcome, Josh.
Why, thank you.
We also have with us Mike Treader. He's the executive director of the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology, and he is one of the most popular and well-received professional speakers on nanotech. And so we're happy to have him with us as well. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you very much.
And we also have Christine Peterson. She writes, lectures, and briefs the media on coming powerful technologies, especially nanotech. She is the co-founder and vice president of Foresight Institute, and so we're also glad to have her with us as well. Welcome, Christine.
Thanks, Stephen. Great to be here.
Well, Stephen, one thing I would add to those introductions is regular listeners, of course, will know that Josh has become quite a regular guest on the program, and of course Christine is a dear friend of the program. We've had her on several times, and we're really pleased to have Mike on for the first time this evening. So it's great to welcome back some old friends and to have a new participant on Fast Forward Radio this evening as well. So we're going to take some time to explore the subject of nanotechnology, and we want to talk about the benefits and the risks of nanotechnology. You might take it from the organizations represented one organization, the Foresight Institute, might be the benefits side, and then the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology might be the risk side. But I think that would be an oversimplification. I think that both these groups have a lot to say on both of those subjects. So I'm looking forward to the perspectives that we get across the board on nanotechnology this evening. But before we get into nanotechnology in particular, we have two questions that we are asking all the participants throughout the 10-week course of The World Transformed about not so much their particular area of interest, although that can come up, and if it does, that's fine, but just generally about how the world is changing. And so I'm going to start randomly with Josh. Josh, a question for you would be, what would you say is the greatest transformation that you've seen to our world in your lifetime, and what do you anticipate to be the greatest transformation you see within your lifetime if it's something different, something coming?
Well, I think the greatest transformation I've seen is what's happened with computers. When I was a kid, nobody had ever seen a computer. I mean, they existed, but, you know, nobody I knew had ever seen one. And when I was in college, there was one on the campus bought with a major NSF grant. And as a budding young futurist, I told my friends that I predicted that by the year 2000, everybody would use a computer at work and nobody would think of anything of that. And they laughed at me and said, "You've got to be nuts." Well, as a matter of fact, you know, we carry around in our pockets, in our cell phones and other gadgetry, computers considerably more powerful than that one super expensive computer that we had at my university back in the 1970s. And that's an amazing technological advance, and it has wrought a significant change on the way we do things in the world. You add networking to that, and the transformation is huge.
Absolutely.
I think in the future,
that's an amazing transformation. Now, looking ahead, what do you see as the largest transformation you expect to see? Same thing, or some variation on that, or something else completely?
Well, I think two main things are going to happen. I think the computer transformation is going to mature into flat-out artificial intelligence, and so that we'll have machines that don't require any special skill at all to let them know what it is you want them to do, and they'll just do it. You tell them, or they'll even be so much smarter than you that, like Jeeves, they'll know what you want without you even realizing yourself. And the other one, of course, is nanotechnology. And basically what that means is that our ability to manipulate the physical world will start advancing at the same rate that our ability to manipulate bits has advanced since about 1950.
So we'll ponder that one for a moment, because that's a huge sweeping statement you just made. When we think about that transition from these big bulky computers to small devices that everyone carries around that are much more powerful, and now you're talking about our interactions with physical matter being undergoing that same kind of transformation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I was in college with this one computer, we had what was the equivalent of about 5 years ago, you could buy a thumb drive that had an amount of storage on it that was measured in megabytes rather than gigabytes. I mean, it's actually hard to get one that small nowadays. But the cost of such thing is now something someone could easily spend and you can carry it around in your pocket. Whereas back only about 30 years before then, it cost quite a few tens of thousands of dollars for that much storage, and it was a 10-ton thing that took up 20 feet along a wall. It was steel cabinets full of punch cards. So the thing is that you expect the same kind of physical advance in technology. Something that costs $50,000 is going to cost $5, and something that used to be 10 tons is going to be so light that you can carry it in your pocket and not be able to notice it. You can apply that to almost anything. Cars. I mean, the cutest trick in the Jetsons is not that their car flies. We know how to do that. Is that when he gets out of his car, he presses a button and it folds up into a briefcase.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
In reality, it's going to fold up into nothing. I mean, it'll just fold up into a tiny little pill or something that'll follow him around, and he won't have to actually touch it. It'll just be there when he wants it, and yours will be there when you want it. There's a wide variety of technologies that are going to contribute to that, but in some sense we already live in a kind of a magical world, but the world of the future after the nanotech revolution will basically just be like flat out magic. I mean, Arthur Clarke's great line that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic is really just going to be completely true. Our technology is going to, because we want to make it this way, we want to make our technology say, anything I want it now, and I want it here, and I don't have to worry about how it got here. And I just want to be able to ask for it in the simplest and easiest of ways and just have it appear in front of me whenever and wherever I want it. And that's clearly been happening in computing. If you look at what you get on an iPhone as opposed to what you had to carry around just 5 years before, a pile of maps and a GPS and a computer and a telephone and all this other stuff. and now it's in your pocket, and 10 years from now, it'll be built into your eyeglasses or maybe even your contact lenses. So the same sort of thing is going to happen with everything that we want to use. Once we are able to apply that same Moore's Law path of development to physical technology as well as informational. And that's what nanotechnology will do for us.
Okay, so you're talking awesome. About the world truly becoming this magical place. I think you've set the bar pretty high for the other two panel members.
Absolutely. Well, Christine, you want to jump in? What's the biggest and most important transformation in your lifetime? And looking forward, what do you expect to see?
Well, you won't be surprised that my answers are similar to Josh's, since we were both at Foresight. We're probably going to have somewhat similar views. Before I heard his answers, I had decided that what I would say for the first one, what was the biggest transformation I've seen so far, that I would say the Internet, which I think is a very similar answer to his, but with a slightly different spin on it. If you think about trying to explain to people who've grown up with the Internet what the world was like beforehand, it's very difficult. It's I don't think they can really picture it. It's so different. Those of us who lived through it, I think, you have to lived through it to really appreciate the change. And then in terms of looking ahead, again, you won't be surprised that my answer is similar to Josh's. I think he gave two answers, artificial intelligence and nanotechnology. You asked for one, so I'm going to force myself to pick one, and I'll pick nanotechnology, specifically what we might call strong nanotechnology or molecular nanosystems, the ability to construct objects with atomic precision. I think that's going to be something it's so hard for us to understand from where we are today that it's a challenge even to think about. But I think it's helpful to people to say, all right, let's think about, for example, the medical applications. Just start there, and that will start to help you understand how different things are going to be.
Absolutely. Do you think, with medical applications, you could actually manufacture molecules that could be useful as drugs, but do you think that in the near future we'll be manufacturing macro objects, large objects with atomic precision, or is that way far off? What are we looking at regarding that?
I've mainly learned, one of the main things I've learned at Foresight is that don't get yourself pinned down on with a date, because who knows whether you're going to be right or wrong. But no, I don't think it's the near future, but I'm hoping that it will be in my lifetime.
Okay,
That's fair enough. We're looking for that flying car that folds into the briefcase or smaller. But if we can't put a date on that quite yet, that's okay. Okay, Mike, same two questions to you. The biggest transformation you've seen in your life to date, and the biggest transformation you expect to see.
Okay. Well, I don't want to entirely copy Josh and Christine, so. I will sort of add a little nuance to what they both said as the greatest transformation, and then I'll give you something different. What I would say in terms of computing and how that's transformed the world in our lifetimes is, to me, the biggest thing that made it all possible is not just the hardware, but specifically the software, and in particular the World Wide Web. The invention of hyperlinks and simple URL protocol and so on, so that everyone could easily access the Internet that had already been there for a couple of decades. And it was that invention of the World Wide Web, which is less than 20 years ago, that I think made the biggest change in computing affecting all of our lives. Obviously, the rapid development of the hardware following Moore's Law has speeded everything up. But without that huge leap in software, without the concept and the standardization that the World Wide Web brought, I don't think we'd have such a pervasive, ubiquitous, and powerful tool at all of our fingertips as we have now. So that's my sort of comment on the computing. But I do want to say another very, very significant transformative change that, that occurred in the world during my lifetime, which is not technology related, is the collapse of the Soviet Union, the you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, 90, 91. If I think most of us on this call are old enough to have lived through the Cold War, and most of us probably grew up with the expectation that, or almost the sense of reality that the United States and the Soviet Union were these two great adversaries and always would be. The world was divided into, you know, the commies and the good guys. that's the way, you know, we were generally raised to see things. And for it all to change in what seemed like almost a blink of an eye overnight within a scope of a couple of years, but so much of it happened within days and weeks, unexpectedly, to most of us. And the world is far, far different now from what it was before. I think that, outside of technology advancement, that is what I see as the most significant transformation in the world that's occurred in my lifetime.
Well, that's a huge one. And what's interesting is to pick up on what Christine said, that it's hard to imagine, hard to explain the world without the internet and without the computer technology that we have today. It's also hard to explain to a child, for example, what the Cold War was like. You know, I mean,
right.
it's that level of a different kind of world. Or I'll tell you another one that I find that's really tricky to talk to young people about is analog technology, right? They've not had to deal with it. You know, it's a really interesting. You know, typewriters are just these museum pieces to them. They're just,
right.
they don't know what to make of it. Well, okay, so that's a great set of answers to get us started. And so now
Hold on.
Those...
You didn't let me say what I think the future transformation will be.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I did not. I cut you off. Go right ahead, Mike. Excuse me.
Again, I have to sort of echo what both Josh and Christine said, that nanotechnology seems to be the thing that has the most potential to be radically transformative in the next few decades. But I think another way to look at it is the convergence of technologies that will actually take place at the nanoscale. And we might call a lot of those things nanotechnology, but they'll also be, you know, biotechnology and genetic engineering and computer or information technology and neurotechnology. And as all of these different fields start coming together at the nanoscale, as our tools get sharper and our understanding grows, that convergence of these technologies, I think, is what's really going to trigger the great transformations, helping us to sort of merge our brains with our computers have our machines and our bodies not any longer necessarily be separate things. So I would say that the convergence of all of these emerging technologies will probably be the most transformative, or lead to the greatest transformations in the next several decades.
Well, actually, it's great that I almost got to the next question, because I think in a sense you may have answered what the next question was in the process of answering completing your answer to the earlier one, which is that if we shift gears and now talk specifically about our subject this evening, nanotechnology, to frame it in the context of our 10-part series here, The World Transformed, very briefly, what is nanotechnology and why would it be part of a series of programs called The World Transformed. And we'll go ahead and start with you, Mike, since you went last time, and I nearly cut you off.
Okay. Yeah, nanotechnology is a word that's been thrown around and, you know, given so many different definitions. I like to say if you ask 100 people what nanotechnology is, you'll get 11 different answers. 10 people will give you their own 10 definitions, and the other 90 will say, I don't know. So it's kind of hard to pin it down. But, the National Nanotechnology Initiative, the National Science Foundation, have a definition that's very broad that basically just says anything that happens under the scale of about 100 nanometers. A nanometer is 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter. The scale of a nanometer is down to the scale of individual atoms and small molecules. And so they're saying that any technology that is working at the scale of under 100 nanometers is nanotechnology. Now, the earliest definition of the term, at least the most the best known early common use of the term by Eric Drexler in the 1980s, referred to a very specific technology that would allow the automated productive and precise combination of atoms to form products. And we still expect that brand of nanotechnology to be the most transformative, although, as Christine said, it's not yet clear how soon that's going to come. But I think in on this show in particular, and what the three of us tend to work on, is the kind of nanotechnology that involves precise manipulation of atoms and molecules to form complete powerful products under computer control, and that's where we believe the field is going and what will be the most transformative.
Okay. Same question to you, Josh, if you have any clarifications or thoughts on the definition or just the overall, why is it something we would talk about on The World Transformed?
Well, I think Mike got it just about right. The main thing that shows up in Drexler's writings and, in fact, in Feynman's famous talk back in 59 before that, was that the use of a machine technology that can produce things of a mechanical nature and do automated operations and produce more machines and more useful products has a sweet spot at the atomic level, because if you're manipulating individual atoms, you suddenly don't have to worry about tolerances anymore. You're making something exactly right, or you're making it exactly wrong. And whereas at the macro scale, when you're machining a shaft or something, you always have this tolerance that you have to worry about, and you can never get it exactly right, and so forth. And the key value of that is that you can make a self-reproducing machine much more easily than you can at a larger scale, assuming that you can manipulate anything at the smaller scale in the first place. And that's why life operates at that scale. So to some extent, what nanotechnology does is not merely propose to manipulate things at the atomic scale. It proposes to be a mechanical substitute for life. It's able to use the molecular level phenomena to do some of the more remarkable things that living materials and so forth can actually come up with, like bones and muscles and whatnot. But it's also capable of replicating itself and doing so at extremely fast rates compared with the capital reinvestment rates that we see in a macro scale technology. And so you're looking at pushing the growth rates of your technology from something like 6% a year to at least 60% a year. And if you really push it fast, more than that. But at the very least, you have a technology that's physically capable of growing at Moore's law rates.
So if we stay with the definition that you just gave, the idea that nanotechnology works at the same scale as life, and it takes on some of the same attributes that life does, the ability to reproduce and so forth. This raises the question of why not use biotechnology? Why not use life as itself as the basis for this technological transformation? Why does nanotechnology have to be something different from that?
Well, there are two main reasons for that. One is that our mechanical technology is actually significantly simpler than life. There are a lot fewer moving parts in a machine that does a particular thing. And in some cases, that's good because it's simpler and easier to understand and easier to design and all that sort of stuff. At the same time, the living thing sometimes has capabilities like growing or healing that the machine doesn't. But the fact is that there are lots of things that we want to build machines to do that we'd rather they just be simple and do exactly what we want rather than have them, you know, run off and be possibly capable of reproducing or turning into a mutant or reproducing in places they're not supposed to and all this sort of stuff. So that in a machine technology, we have a much greater control and a much clearer understanding of what's actually going on. The other thing is that right now, life does not operate on all the kinds of materials that we could make if we were to harness a machine technology. Life doesn't produce diamond. It doesn't work with high speed or high energy reactions. And therefore, there's a whole range of processes and materials that a machine-like technology at the nanoscale could use and products that it could create, like rockets and so forth, that life would have a very hard time doing. Now, the fact is that ultimately they'll converge. Ultimately, people will extend the capabilities of living systems, and people will take the machine-based systems and make them more and more complex. And in the long run, probably by a century from now, there'll be this broad spectrum of stuff that you can't really tell where one stops and the other one starts. But in the short run, the machine-based stuff is just easier to understand. It's easier to design, and it has greater capabilities in the same sort of places that our existing machine technology has greater capabilities, i.e., you know, it can manipulate hard and stiff stuff like steel and stand high temperatures and move really fast and so forth, where life is limited in the temperature ranges and the energies of the reactions and the speeds and all that other sorts of process parameters that you'd like to be able to extend.
So you have something. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, excuse me. This is Mike. I'd like to just say one other thing about that. Obviously, I agree with what Josh said. And the other point that I think we ought to make is that as well as life processes have been able to adapt to, you know, different environments and changing circumstances over billions of years, it has done it very slowly. And evolution and, you know, life itself is not necessarily efficient. In fact, it's pretty much the opposite of efficient. It kind of just throws everything it can up against the wall to see what will stick. That's how natural selection operates. And what we're expecting is that nanotechnology and these other emerging technologies will be directed where natural selection is not, will be precise, which natural selection is not, and therefore will certainly be far more efficient. For example, life was able to evolve animals that could fly, birds, bats, insects, but life never evolved wings, fixed wings, and propellers, or wheels, for example. Man's ingenuity and technology invented better ways to do things than life could do, and we'll continue to do that, learning from, making use of the biotechnology or the biosystems that are there, but we don't have to be limited by it. And in fact, kind of saying, well, we have to rely on what life has done up till this point is really very limiting. And we can continue to do much better than that.
Well, I think that's a great way of kind of setting the stage, the difference between those two. It's like some of the properties of life, but in a more versatile, simpler, faster kind of a medium. Although I have to take issue with you on just one thing there, Mike. I used to have a huge maple tree in my front yard, and life took one good shot at propellers anyway.
Yeah, well, I agree. I love those little propellers.
Yeah, it tried anyhow. Okay, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with a panel of nanotechnology experts, and we're getting into the discussion of benefits and risks of nanotechnology. As soon as we round out our opening question on the definition of nanotechnology and how it might transform the world. And so I'll turn it over to you, Christine. Do you have anything to add either to the definition or the transformative potential of nanotechnology?
I think we did fine on the definition. In terms of the transformative potential, when we think of the phrase the world transformed, we can think politically and culturally, we can think about communications, but if you want to think about physical things, then nanotechnology is the answer for how will the world be transformed. The two favorite examples that I like to look at are, number one, how do we transform our world from a polluted one to a clean one? And that's what pulled me into nanotechnology originally, was excitement about making truly clean technologies, truly clean manufacturing. And the other transformation that we all would like to have is medical. How do we transform human bodies that have disease, human bodies that are aging, into truly healthy human bodies? So those are two types of transformations that I, for one, am looking forward to.
Okay, well, that's
Christine,
great. That actually, sorry, Stephen, I was just going to say that dovetails exactly into our list of topics, but go ahead, Stephen.
I was just going to comment that Christine is my type of environmentalist, addressing our environmental problems with technology rather than relinquishing technology.
Absolutely, the way forward is a technological path. Christine, you mentioned two things that actually are the first two things on the list. What I thought we would do next, if the panel is willing, is I've got a list of potential application areas for nanotechnology, and what I will do is I will toss these out. And I would like for the panel to give me some idea of what the major benefits of nanotechnology would be within that application area, and then also some thought as to what potential risks might be incurred in terms of directing nanotechnology in that direction. And Christine, since you brought it up, it's your turn to go first. We'll start with medicine. Can you give us a quick outline in your view of what the major benefits will be of nanomedicine and also any risks that you see?
Well, if by nanomedicine we're referring to the longer term abilities of molecular nanosystems to actually repair the human body, the medical benefits are just about anything you can think of in terms of what goes wrong with our bodies, how can we find out what it is that's wrong, this sort of imaging, diagnostics, those kinds of things, detection of problems. And then, of course, the more challenging issue of, all right, once we know what the problem is, how can we persuade the molecules of our bodies to do what they're supposed to do, what a young, healthy body does, rather than what an aging or a diseased tissue does. So molecular nanosystems in the long term, combined with advanced software, should be able to do both these things, the diagnostics, the imaging, and then actual repairs. Of course, this is an extremely ambitious application, but it's the natural one that people are going to want to see.
Well, you know, we had Terry Grossman on the show last week. We were talking about the era of the indefinite lifespan, talking about life extension, and one of the things that that he talked about was in his book that he and Ray Kurzweil had written about life extension. This notion of bridge technologies, of making it long enough on nutraceuticals and a healthy lifestyle and those kinds of things until you get to the point where the next big bridge technology. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe that in his and Ray Kurzweil's view, that next big bridge technology is in fact the kind of nanotechnology that you're talking about.
That could be. I don't know what they're picturing after that. If that's a bridge technology, what in the world comes after that? But
well, after that, you upload to another substrate, I believe. I see.
Yeah. All right. Well, some of us are okay with the current substrate. We just want it to work better. So.
Well, if you can live indefinitely in that one, yeah, you know, no rush, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we have to have backups too. That's important. But so that's the first part to your question. And then the second question you had was about risks. Well, whenever you develop a new technology, there are risks along the way while you're ironing out the kinks. Of course, that's standard. In terms of sort of intrinsic risks to a successful nanomedicine technology. I'm not sure that there's a risk in the sense that the technology would necessarily go wrong for the individual who's being treated. Some people might argue that there's a risk of overpopulation if we had wonderful nanomedicine. I would argue against that, but some might see it that way.
Mike, do you have an opinion about nanomedicine?
Yeah, obviously I have lots of opinions. the thing that I see as far as nanomedicine, as Christine says, there are downsides to every technology, and in the development stages, every new nanomedical technique will have to be tested and made sure that it's safe and achieves the desired effect and so on. That's pretty much standard practice, and we're generally good at that in society. My biggest concern, though, is that the benefits that we would like to get from nanomedicine and from nanotechnology as a whole, whether it's to, as Christine said, help to clean up the environment, to allow clean manufacturing, to produce sustainable energy, and so on, that all of those benefits will be curtailed because the technology might be used in less beneficial ways and, you know, might be used to create more powerful weapons or to for one group or one nation to try to gain dominance over others, and that the resulting struggle over power, you know, who gets to control the technology, that the struggle for power will be so distracting and possibly destructive that we won't get the benefits either as soon as we want them or as widespread as we want them. And of course, I know I'm maybe getting ahead of us a little bit, but that's why the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology was formed, was to explore those things. And as you said at the beginning, The Foresight Nanotech Institute and the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology both are interested in understanding the benefits and the risks of nanotechnology. And I don't think either one of our groups is more concerned with one side than the other. We all want to see the best outcomes with the least possible downsides.
Okay. All right. Josh, I'm sure you want to weigh in on nanomedicine while we're on the subject.
Okay. Let's see. Well, I think the general issues have been addressed very nicely already. So I'm going to just point out a couple of actual possible applications that could happen in the early days once we had molecular nanotechnology. One of the key things that nanotechnology will give us is the ability to manipulate and invent and build and install things at the scale of small cells or things inside of cells. And yet, at the same time, we still don't understand how everything in the body works. And so, as Christine says, one of the big things that nanotech is going to do is give us the ability to do the science, to understand how things work, so that later in this century, we're actually ready to go in and start fixing things in a big way, or reinventing and ultimately changing the substrate and all that sort of stuff. But piece by piece, there are parts of it that we do understand, and so we can begin replacing pieces. I mean, the classic example is Rob Freitas' respirocyte, a replacement for the red blood cell, or even just some of the red blood cells. You don't have to replace them all, but you put them in there, and basically the main function of the red blood cell is to carry oxygen. It goes to the lungs and it releases CO2 and it picks up some oxygen and it goes back out the rest of the bloodstream and it sucks up CO2 and it releases oxygen. And we can build a machine that will do that considerably more efficiently and with a much higher capacity. And that will allow you to hold your breath for 4 hours and do all sorts of cool stuff and live under the ocean and whatnot. But a possibly even more interesting application is that every single one of our cells is full of these little bodies that are actually, historically speaking, symbiotes that have worked out to be parts of our cells. The mitochondria, and what they do is to essentially, they're the little power plants in the cell, and they take the oxygen and the fats or the sugars or whatever it is you happen to be metabolizing at the time, and use the energy that they get from that oxidation to turn ADP into ATP, which proceeds to provide energy for all the other reactions that happen inside the cell, well, almost all. And they, because they're descended from bacteria rather than our other ancestors, are genetically significantly different from our DNA, and they're flakier. They break down more easily. They don't reproduce as reliably, and the fact that the mitochondria flake out is one of the main things that happens in aging. And so because the mitochondrion has a simple fixed function and it's a completely separate organelle inside the cell, once you've got the basic technology to be able to go into your cells and work at that scale, you could build essentially a robotic mitochondrion and begin replacing your mitochondria with these robotic ones that would actually work better and last longer and all that good stuff. So this is the sort of thing that you would begin to see people doing once we got the ability to build machinery at that level and to actually operate on cells.
That's a particularly awesome. Interesting one in light of our guest last week. In addition to Terry Grossman, we had Aubrey de Grey on, and we were talking about his strategies for engineered negligible senescence.
I'm sure that came up.
Yeah, at least two of those have to do with mitochondria, I'm pretty sure. So what I like about that is in Ending Aging, he talks about all these elaborate things we could do to maybe patch or fix or get the mitochondria to work better. This idea of, well, we'll just swap out that old, not very effective part with a better part, a little mitochondria robot to do the work instead sounds pretty appealing.
Absolutely.
I like it.
Well, you know, Aubrey's solution was a little bit different, but he was seeing the same problem exactly. His solution is moving the DNA from the mitochondria into the cell nucleus itself with all its air checking going on within the nucleus so that you don't have that same problem. But yeah, if we can get that problem solved, we're well on the way, aren't we?
Let me mention something here about the benefit of nanotechnology in this area of medicine and life extension and so forth. And that is that it might not be that difficult to invent techniques to, let's say, improve on the mitochondria or the red blood cells. But in order to actually implement that invention, you have to have a technology that can produce products with great precision and in huge numbers, not too expensively. For example, if you wanted to replace the blood cells in your body, you're talking about, I don't know, how many blood cells do you have in your body? Billions?
Or at least a couple dozen, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
And so that's not something you can, you can do in a lab making a few cells every hour. It's going to require a technology that can follow computer instructions, that can automate essentially a production line, like a factory only shrunk down to the nanoscale, what we call a nanofactory, that can produce to exact precision billions of identical products and do them at very low cost. That's the kind of benefit that nanotechnology, advanced nanotechnology, will bring to not only the medical field, but really to just about any other field you can think of. So it's not only the invention of the idea, but the implementation that makes nanotechnology potentially so transformative.
Well, speaking of other fields, Mike, our next area of application is actually the other one that Christine had mentioned, which is the environment. So perhaps you could give us your quick rundown on how you think nanotechnology can be applied to addressing environmental problems, including climate change, if applicable, and any risks that might be involved with that.
Yeah, it certainly is the most likely emerging technology that will be powerful enough and efficient and cheap enough to really be able to make a difference in the short span that we have in order to prevent climate change from raising sea levels by several feet this century, increasing average global temperatures by 5 degrees, let's say, which would really be disastrous. You're talking about mass migrations of both refugees and animals and insects and diseases and really a disaster on the scale that mankind has never experienced. Whether that is able to be headed off, I think, will rely to a large extent on nanotechnology. There are many proposals flying around out there. In fact, I heard Josh give a talk a few months ago in which he said, well, we could create, with nanotechnology, create trillions of tiny balloons with mirrors in them and suspend them in the upper atmosphere to either block out sunlight or direct it where we want it, and and therefore be able to take over the temperature control of the Earth. Whether or not that's the best solution or whether it can even be accomplished remains to be seen. But if that's the scale of what sort of possibilities we're talking about, really revolutionizing energy production and obviously manufacturing, transportation, every industry you can think of, and along the way, both remediating the damage that we've done to the natural environment and hopefully getting a handle on climate change to the extent that it won't be as damaging as it might otherwise be. Now, the downside of this powerful technology is that as easy as it seems to apply the right answers or to find good solutions and put them into effect, it also enables people who may think they have good solutions but haven't thought them out well and end up having all sorts of unintended consequences. There's a significant risk that in the wrong hands, a sort of a rogue application of what we call planet-scale engineering, nanotechnology writ large, could backfire, could cause more environmental damage than it fixes, and so it's going to cry out for international cooperation. That's the sort of thing that the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology has been urging, is for corporations, governments, and NGOs, civil society, to talk about these issues before the technology is developed so that we can make sure that it's not used inappropriately.
Okay. Christine, thoughts on the environmental applications of nanotech? Hello, Christine.
Oh, I still see her number here on the switchboard, Phil. Well,
okay,
Josh,
we'll work on getting her back. Yeah, go ahead, Josh. Maybe you have some thoughts.
Yeah, actually, a couple of thoughts. Just to start with the craziest one first. I have a column coming out in H Plus magazine. It's in press at this point. But I point out that it's actually possible to build a human being at about 1/1,000th scale. And if we were to, in fact, transform all the humans this way, we could reduce our footprint on the Earth by a factor of a billion, because the total volume and therefore the total amount of resources that we would use would go down by the cube of the scale factor. So the total footprint of the human race would be the same as 5 current humans. Now technology really has a huge capability to address these issues, and that's just sort of a in-your-face way of pointing that out. I think in the long run,
that is a terrific example. Actually, that really is in your face when you talk about that level of transference, right? The entire footprint being reduced to that of, did you say 5 people?
Yeah, well, a factor of a billion.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty good.
So by the end of the century, 10 people, you know. But the I think sort of a little less wild-eyed or blue sky, we can talk about the fact that with relatively straightforward uses of nanotechnology, it's going to be possible to move as much of the human race as we want off into completely artificial environments in space using the material and energy in the rest of the solar system. And that's the only way we are going to preserve the Earth in anything resembling a pristine natural form, because the number of people and the things they want and the amount of power that they're going to have is simply not going to allow the human race to sort of sit here. I mean, if you look at what's actually causing the worst ecological disasters anywhere, it's the fact that people build these cities and they just totally destroy the environment that was there before they started paving everything over. And they're growing, and they're not going to stop. And if you don't do something like say, okay, let's at least save this planet as a park and take the other 20,000 Earth's worth of space that we can build out there just from the asteroids alone, and probably a lot more than that once we understand how to do things. We're going to have Trantor, you know, the world city where there's nothing but metal and concrete. Nobody is going to want to, but it's just going to work out that way. So I think that getting the human race into a situation where we have alternatives to using up the Earth is going to be the key to preserving the Earth.
Well, I'm geek enough to admit that I think it would be pretty cool to have Trantor, I guess, if we built it someplace else, you know, like on Mars or something like that. Right. We don't want to do that to the Earth, though. And I'm intrigued by the idea.
It's the only planet we have.
Yeah.
Nice
right now, it's the only one we have. Yeah. So we save the Earth by most of us leaving. Basically, that's the idea.
Well, that would help.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
There's plenty of room out there. There's plenty of energy out there, and there's plenty of matter out there. What we need is a technology that allows us to use that to live well. And given that, I think we will. Now, frankly, I sort of agree and sort of disagree with Mike. I'm not nearly as concerned about the climate change issue as he is, primarily because I think that, the invention of mine that he talked about, which I call the weather machine, is essentially a form of a negative greenhouse gas. And there's a thousand different ways you can create a negative greenhouse gas. And we have technology to do some of them now, and nanotechnology will give us a lot more options depending on exactly how we want to do that. So if we want to tailor the atmosphere, nanotechnology will give us the ability to do that, and we'll get to look at questions like what temperature do we want it to be and how much CO2 do we want to have in the air, and they're not necessarily linked because we'll have the ability to change them independently. Nobody has addressed those. I mean, everybody has sort of assumed that they're linked, and yet they're not necessarily linked. But I also agree with him, and I want to put an underline on what he said, that if somebody goes and builds a weather machine, the kind that I invented and talked about, the little balloons that can control all the sunlight reaching the Earth and all the long-wave radiation escaping it, that's a huge existential risk. If you use that wrong, we're all dead. That weather machine, that cure is a lot worse than the disease if it's not used properly. And so I think that confronting the fact that we're seriously in danger of being able to build something that will, you know, with the one push of a button instantly kill us all is thought-provoking. And I think we have to look very carefully at the structures of our governance and how something like that would be controlled before we build it.
Well, it is thought-provoking to say the very least. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with our panel about nanotechnology, and we're going to be moving a little bit more rapidly through our topics as we close out the program here. Before we move on to the next one, though, I certainly want to give Christine the opportunity to address the environment, seeing as she had originally brought the subject up. I think we've fixed our little technical difficulties. Are you with us, Christine?
I hope so.
Yes. Oh, good.
Yes.
Okay, great. About the environment, as I had said earlier, those applications are what pulled me initially into nanotechnology. And certainly that the need for those improvements has only increased over the years since I originally got involved. To those of us who care deeply about the environment, the natural environment, the current situation, especially in terms of what's happening with the oceans, for example, can be just a matter for despair. If things are so bad, the question is, how can we possibly fix this problem? And it's the only solution I see is with some kind of advanced nanotechnology that can tackle this problem across the board. It's very important to me that we clean up the mess we've made and stop adding more pollution to the environment. Now, Josh is talking about more ambitious projects, geoengineering type things. Those, as he was pointing out, have their risks. And so we go down that path if we have to. In other words, if the problems are so severe that that's the only way to handle them, I guess we're going to have to go down that path. For the moment, I would be thrilled if we could just begin to undo some of the damage we've already done. And that's what I find is so exciting about nanotechnology, really being able to clean up the environment and being able to have truly clean manufacturing so that we can persuade people to do things in a clean way without having to sacrifice their standard of living, which, frankly, they don't seem to be willing to do.
Can I just jump in here for a second? This is Mike again.
Sure, Mike, go ahead.
I just want to say that I think all three of us, me and Josh and Christine, agree that technology has to be part of the solution, and that nanotechnology in particular has a tremendous amount of potential to deal with the environmental issues, the medical hopes that we have, and so on. Where we might have some disagreement, like where Josh says that he and I don't necessarily think of climate change as I might emphasize it as more of a danger than he does, because my concern is that having the technology itself does not mean that it's going to be applied wisely. It does not mean it's going to be used to make things better or fix the problems. We have to have the technology in order to reach good solutions, but it's the people, it's the, you know, the politics, the human side of the equation that actually is going to apply the solutions. And so I'm not always optimistic that we will make good use of this powerful technology. As Josh said, we will reach a stage within the next few decades where one small group or even one individual could achieve so much potential power that he or she could do really great damage. We're reaching the extreme of what Fareed Zakaria calls the democratization of violence, where individuals will possibly be enabled with such destructive potential that either some form of draconian control is going to have to be exerted, or some sort of, you know, reengineering of the human psyche so that destructive impulses are removed. These technologies bring up potential, you know, answers, but unfortunately they raise as many questions as they do answers along the way.
Well, speaking of questions, you've actually raised you've raised a good one there, Mike, and I'm gonna give this one right back to you. Does the democratization of violence also not provide us with a democratization of defense? And that was actually one of the topics on our list of applications of nanotechnology. How does nanotechnology help us to make the world a safer place?
Well, it's a it's a difficult question that's not yet been answered, whether offense or defense, so to speak, will be the you know, will gain the most from these new technologies. And I actually am concerned that that this democratization of violence will make the world a less safe place. It will reduce stability. It will have the potential to rapidly change the balance of power, and you know, make it less make it more difficult for nations to understand what each other might be doing or what level of power they possess at any given time. I tend to think that the offense is going to have the advantage over the defense because of the element of surprise. That defense is, by definition, is always reactive. And as this technology allows the development of new and more powerful weapons or other damaging devices on a really rapid time scale that we've never seen before, when the production cycle for new generations of weapons, for example, instead of being years as it is now, when it's reduced to months or even weeks, it's going to be really, really difficult for any sort of defensive effort, I think, to keep up with that.
Christine, well, I'm sorry, go ahead, Josh.
I have to jump on that a little bit and bring up the space angle again. The increase in the technological power of things like nanotechnology are to some extent like crowding, 17 people all with machine guns inside of a phone booth and telling them to get along together. But the phone booth is the Earth. And if you take the ability that technology gives you to travel in an unconstrained environment, there's a natural balance between attack and defense, or at least the ability to get away and the ability to live far enough from other agents that you're able to detect them coming and therefore reduce the element of surprise. And there's a natural balance with any given technology up until you hit a situation where you have an artificial limit. Which is what happens when you talk about the Earth as a whole, when the technology gets to the point where it ought to be extending beyond the Earth. If you stop the increase in the reachable environment, but continue the increase in the effectiveness of the technology, and the imbalance occurs. And so for the balance to be put back in place, you have to increase the size of the environment that people are living in, and that again means moving off of the Earth, and that restores the balance to one where defense is marginally better than offense, and things are stable, and you can have a situation sort of more like it was before the invention of rockets and ICBMs and nuclear weapons and so forth.
No lesser light than Stephen Hawking thinks the same exact way about that issue. He says, without us moving off the Earth, we're going to be doomed to extinction. Christine, what's your thought? Do the good guys win, are we able to defend against this?
Yeah, I'm actually hopeful, and it's not that I'm saying that that Mike is wrong here, that there's a problem. There is a problem. There's going to be a problem. We can get a feel for how this is going to play out by looking at the world of software viruses currently over the Internet, and we can see the forces for good and evil fighting it out there. And we can also get a pointer toward, how can we approach this problem? Is there an answer? And I think we've seen that that the good guys can get some advantage. First, there's more of them, thank goodness, and I think that will continue to be true. And the question is, how can they collaborate better? How can they use tools to become a better team. And I think we see that in the open source software world, where open source software is faster than proprietary software at responding to viral challenges. I think that can be said to be true. So what we've done at Foresight is we're exploring a new space. And actually, this whole area was pointed at in the original book, Engines of Creation, in terms of collaborative defense. It's the term I started using originally was open source physical security. In other words, how do we use the open source tool set in the world of security in the physical world? Since then, I've renamed it, at least for a while, to open source sensing. And you can see the website at opensourcesensing.org, where we're exploring these very issues. They're real issues, they're real concerns, but I do think the good guys have a chance if they use the tools of collaboration that we are starting to see work so well in software.
We'll be sure to include a link to open source sensing in the show notes, Stephen.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that people fight about and presently is energy, and I imagine nanotech is going to play big in that field as well. Michael, what do you think? What's the future for nanotech within the field of energy?
Well, it's extremely promising. In fact, it's the main technology that has the potential to get us off the addiction to petroleum or fossil fuels by making, whether it's solar energy, much more efficient, or even wind, or geothermal, or tidal power, all of those things that are possible, but with today's levels of technology, they're either too expensive or just impractical to achieve. But when we have molecular manufacturing, that is, you know, atomically precise, exponential manufacturing that can produce products inexpensively and in great quantities or even in great sizes, then we can start to explore some of the things that before now were only science fiction. As Christine has said, and I love quoting her on this, when you're looking toward the future and you see something that looks like science fiction, well, it might be true, but if it doesn't look like science fiction, it's almost certainly not right. I didn't quite phrase that the way she does, but it's a great thought. In any case, we do have the possibility over the next few decades to really transform the world of energy production and make it sustainable, renewable, cost-effective, environmentally friendly. The big question mark here, however, is who's going to control that potentially trillion-dollar industry? Is it left in the hands of, you know, people like ExxonMobil, who have been anything but reliable in doing the right thing with all of their power? Or can it be that we can have distributed or even open source solutions that might achieve some of what we want without the downside of concentration of power that has gotten us into all the problems that we're having now?
Okay, so other responses to that one, either Josh or Christine, thoughts on that?
Well, I have one. To a very, very close approximation, all of the matter that we can see in the universe is part of nuclear reactors, fusion reactors to be precise. That's the stars. The universe is flooded with energy, and we're idiots if we just sit here on our butts and mope about it. We just need to go out and get it. The solar system is flooded with billions of times more energy than we currently use. If you look at the ability to harvest that energy, even if you're just sitting on the surface of the earth and picking up solar power, Nanotechnology makes a huge difference because the current solar cells, for example, tend to use rare and poisonous elements like cadmium in their structure for the solid state conversion of photons into electric potential. But you can do the same thing with nothing but carbon if you can just put the atoms in the right place. You make a dipole antenna and a high-frequency diode that have both been demonstrated in the lab. We just don't have the physical technology to produce them, even though the material is dirt cheap. It's just that capability to manufacture at the molecular scale that's standing between us and clean, cheap solar power that doesn't use the rare and poisonous materials that our current technology needs to have.
So with that capability in our in our grasp, how does the energy landscape change, do you think?
I think basically it disappears. I mean, as a problem, it'll be like the 60s again when the world was everybody's oyster because energy was an enabler rather than a brake on everything else we tried to do.
Fair enough. Okay, Christine, any additional thoughts on energy, or have we covered this one?
Just to wrap it up, I'd say I agree that the problem is solvable with advanced nanotechnology. We should be able to finally be able to collect and store energy, first collect it from solar energy and then store it in a variety of ways efficiently to make it, to basically solve the problem. Just to pick up on something Mike mentioned, which is the question of control and ownership of technology. That is an issue. It's a concern, and one thing we pay some attention to at Foresight is the question of ownership of publicly funded research in nanotechnology. Do we like the way that's handled now? Are there improvements that need to be made? I would say there definitely are improvements that need to be made in terms of how publicly funded research turns into patents and products, and who owns those patents.
Christine, I've got a question for you from the chat room. Our listener, my friends call me Tiny, has raised this question, I think partially in response to your ideas about open source, and since there's probably no one better to ask about open source than you. The question is, doesn't history show that the controlling oligarchy always keeps the best tech to themselves to ensure their control? Would you agree that that's an accurate statement and that's fair to project that going forward?
Well, I'm not sure I would say that. I mean, would we say that there's a controlling oligarchy controlling the Internet in the United States? I'm not sure we would say that. I certainly, if you look at China, they're making a good effort over there to do it. But in terms of the rest of the world, I'm not sure we can say that the Internet is really well controlled by an oligarchy. I can agree that this can happen, and maybe it often happens, but it doesn't have to happen. So I think we need to pay some attention to head it off.
Yeah, in fact, my thought on that is that some of these technologies, open technologies, have in fact helped bring down oligarchies, or at least temper their power to a certain extent. And my favorite example of that would be the mainstream media, who would never give Stephen and myself a radio program, and yet here we are talking with the three of you tonight. We brought them down so that it's a great leveler of regular people having access to power that, you know, in the past really was just controlled by a few. It seems to me that that we see really people being more empowered as some of these technologies develop.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think he's also right. He or she is also correct. We need to be vigilant on these things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, we're down to our final few minutes here. And, Stephen, we had several more of these applications to do, but I'm just going to pick one randomly. I think maybe the economy would probably be the one that's on everyone's mind. So let's Let's talk about very quickly, 50 words or less each of you, and we'll start with Josh this time. What does nanotechnology do to transform our economy? What are the potential benefits and what are the potential risks?
Well, I think we've got to go through another phase change that's comparable to the Industrial Revolution. And to some extent, that's become a fairly banal thing to say about nanotech, but with molecular manufacturing and the rates of physical capital reinvestment that you get from self-replicating machines, I think it's a lot truer than people realize, and that life will just be completely different after it, the same way life was different in 1900 than it was in 1500. That same difference will span the coming century, and I don't think there's going to be any one single point at which you can say it happened, but it will certainly happen inside of this coming century. The standard of living of people will go up by a couple of orders of magnitude. And completely different economic systems will be in play, and attitudes will vastly change, and pretty much all the other major kind of transformations in society that you can think of that come from that much of a change in just the physical way that we live or can live are going to happen.
Okay. Mike, quickly, how is the economy going to be transformed by nanotech?
Fundamentally transformed. When manufacturing is moved from block-long factories to desktop factories, when individuals are able to produce essentially any product that they can download a design for from the internet at pennies on the pound, then what happens to all of those major companies that today are making the products that we all buy? What happens to all the people who are working in the stores? It's going to be a level of creative destruction, as Joseph Schumpeter calls it, that we've never seen before in the economy of the world. In the long run, it's very likely to be a positive thing, but unless it's managed carefully, it could also be very disruptive and potentially destructive for a lot of individuals along the way.
Okay. Christine, you got the last word. How is the economy going to be transformed by nanotech?
Well, I would agree with both Josh and Mike on these things. There's lots of good news. The physical products that we want and that people need to live should become extremely inexpensive, at least the open source versions of them, which are going to be good enough, I think, to live on. And I think that there is an issue about the have-nots of the world, and those could increase in terms of as the value of physical labor decreases. We're going to have to address that. It's absolutely true. But I look forward to having that opportunity. Let's put it that way.
All right.
Well,
all right.
I certainly like the image that Josh that you painted of a world in which we're moving up by our economic scale by several orders of magnitude. Josh, last time you were on the program, we talked about my projected future that we talk about on the Speculist from time to time, in which we all become sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers. And so it's very important that we get those two orders of magnitude or three up, I think, in order to have that kind of throwing around sort of money. But seriously, it sounds like from all three of you, from a practical standpoint, that the economic impact might be as big as anything else that any other impact that nanotechnology has, that will transform society. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, in 1500, what percentage of the population had a ton of armor and 100 horses? And yet you have that in
a small percentage.
As far as, your car is essentially that for many reasons, and in physical terms. So it's very, very reasonable to expect that after molecular manufacturing comes through, at least the physical capabilities of the average person will be roughly more like those of the billionaire today. You can hop on your private flying car, jet, or whatever you want to call it, and have dinner in Honolulu. With AI, you'll also have the ability to call on the skills of 1,000 people to solve your problems for the same price that currently you spend on your iPhone.
Well, there you have superpowers. Plus, you already gave us via those nano corpuscles the ability to hold our breath for 4 hours. So I'm pretty satisfied. I got to say, you're getting us closer all the time. Each time you come on the show, you're getting me a little closer to that end game. So I very much appreciate that. Well, we are very near the end of our time, just long enough to thank all three of our panelists, Jay Storrs Hall, Christine Peterson, and Mike Treader. Thank you all three very much. It's been tremendously exciting time talking with you this evening. The time, of course, has just completely flown by, but we look forward to having you all, each of you, on the program again in the future.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, Stephen, that wraps us up. What have you got going on for us music-wise this evening?
Okay, the song is Bigger Love, and the artist is Spadey. Okay, so...
Okay, let me make sure I got the name right. Spadey.
That's right.
Spadey singing Bigger Love. Okay, well, I like the name. I like the artist's name. Should be a fun one. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen, and for all your contributions to the program. Michael Darling, we heard from you briefly. Hope you're doing all right out there in Cyberland. All of our terrific input in the chat room this evening. Thanks everyone for providing that, and for everyone listening live. And for everyone listening via MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back next week with part 4 of The World Transformed. Until then, live to see it.
I need a bigger love.